Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. At the age of 14 years old, Jim Byron started working at the California-based Nixon Foundation as a marketing intern. This past November, at age 28, he was appointed president and CEO of the foundation. Mr. Byron joined Q&A to talk about the Nixon Foundation and its role in operating the Nixon Library and Museum in Yorba Linda, California. He also spoke about his goals for the foundation, including getting more young people interested in the life and legacy of President Nixon. Our conversation will begin in just a moment.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
These are some of the letters that President and Mrs. Nixon wrote to each other between 1938 and when they were married in 1940, and that show their courtship. These are incredibly rare. They were just recently released by the Nixon Foundation in 2012. So this is a letter that was written by President Nixon to Mrs. Nixon. It's not dated, but he writes to her, "Dearest heart," he says, "let's go for a long ride Sundays. Let's go to the mountains on weekends. Let's read books in front of fires. Most of all, let's really grow together and find the happiness we know is ours. My love to thee, dear heart, Dick." So what this letter really shows us is a romantic side of a young President Nixon that really wasn't public before these letters were released.
Jim Byron, that is video from C-SPAN from 2013, our First Lady series, when we first met you in an earlier role with the Nixon Foundation. On November 3rd, just 1 month ago today, as a matter of fact, the foundation board chose you at age 28 to be the new head, the new CEO of the Nixon Foundation. Tell me about this new role, why you took it, and what your goals are.
Thanks, Susan, and thanks for having me on this morning. It's a very exciting role, and I'm deeply honored by the trust that the board of directors of the Nixon Foundation has placed in me. You know, we're a nonprofit. There's only 13 presidential foundations around the country. We're all about education. So we're all about encouraging and supporting scholarship, sponsoring programs that engage the public with American civics and history, and putting on special exhibits here at the Nixon Library. If I can use those tools, our mission work, to deepen an understanding about Richard Nixon and Mrs. Nixon and their times, the times in which they served, particularly among millennials, people my age, I'm only 28, to you know, come to a fuller understanding about who President Nixon was, then I will have done, a good job in this role. You know, a big part of that, too, is continuing our very positive relationship with our partners and friends at the National Archives in Washington. We cooperate the Nixon Library. The National Archives controls the archives, and the foundation puts on all sorts of educational programs, and we work together to bring people here to the Nixon Library to deepen understanding and to encourage people to come here and study and learn and make up their own minds about who Richard Nixon was. If I can help the foundation to build up its presence in Washington with programming and fundraising support, that's certainly a worthwhile goal. I want to institute a number of podcast series. Again, it's millennials that really are a target audience in the sense. If we can support scholarship and deepen an understanding of President Nixon through podcast series and other digital outlets, that will be a big win. And then, you know, we are beginning a very successful series of conferences on a number of you know, key legacy elements of the Nixon legacy, and so we'd want to program those out once every year or every other year, to really build up awareness that there's so much to this fascinating man and his legacy and the times in which he served. So if I can get a fraction of that done over the next couple of years, I think that my goals will have been fulfilled.
By my calculations, at age 28, you were born 1 year before Richard Nixon died. So what inspired your interest in him?
You know, it didn't really start with an interest in Richard Nixon, so to speak. It started with just an interest in American history. You know, I had a very close relationship with my grandfather on my mother's side, and he was a history buff. And he brought me into this world. We'd watch news clips together and history programs together. We'd watch C-SPAN together. And that was how I came to really have a passion for history, and in particular 20th century American history. I minored in it as an undergrad in college. And so, you know, when I was a student, a high school student, I was looking for volunteer opportunities. Honestly, Susan, I was bored over the summer, and this opportunity came up, much to my surprise. The folks at the Nixon Foundation said, okay, we'll give this kid a shot. And so really through osmosis, I began learning about the Nixon presidency and legacy, and what a legacy it is. So, you know, that's really how it got started. And then I continued to volunteer my time when I was in high school over the summers, and I learned a lot. Read every conceivable book that you could about. I read President Nixon's memoirs, several of his books. I read about Dean Kotlowski on Nixon's civil rights, Evan Thomas being Nixon, books on Watergate. I mean, it is just, where do you even start with Richard Nixon? He is so endlessly and absolutely fascinating. So, the more and more that I could soak in. It was really served to benefit my understanding, and that's how it started. So then I learned about nonprofits, learned about fundraising, learned about programming, and I had some very close mentors along the way that helped me out every step of the way. And so when Hugh Hewitt took over as president of the foundation back in the July of 2019, he asked me to be his number two and essentially to run the staff, run all operations at the library, and I gladly accepted. And so Hugh has made a decision to go back onto the board and recommended that I succeed him. And much to my luck, the board of directors agreed. So that's really how it all turned out.
Yeah, the press release last month on your announcement said that that first stint that you took at the library as a youngster, you were age 14. So how many of your contemporaries were interested in presidential politics and particularly Nixon history as you were at that age?
Very few. Very few. But yeah, it's something that I think set me apart. I've always been an old soul. But it's done well for me.
When along this path now, 14 years, did you decide that you wanted to make presidential history, museum management, and public history a career?
Actually, rather recently. You know, particularly with the Nixon Foundation being on the ascent that I believe that it is. You know, there's just such an interest in Richard Nixon today that I hope that we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit more about. You know, he is endlessly fascinating. There are 17 books by my count that are in the works right now about him, his life, his times, and his legacy. And I thought, you know, if I can help to deepen the understanding of this crucial man who was so crucial to a 50-year period in American and world history, I will have been doing my community a service, I will have been doing my friends a service, doing the board a service, and really doing, I think, American history a service. So that's what keeps me going every day.
We'll have a more time to talk about some of the points you raised, but you are talking to us from the campus of the Nixon Library and Museum, which is Yorba Linda, California. Does the foundation own the campus?
We do. We own all 9 acres.
And where? How far is it from Whittier, California, where Richard Nixon was born?
It's only about 15 miles. He was born here in Yorba Linda. He was born in a small home that his father built out of a kit, and it's right here on the property at the Nixon Library, and it's now open to visitors. So actually about 6 million visitors have walked through that home over the last 30 years.
So where does Whittier play a role in his life story?
Well, of course, the family moved to Whittier when he was 9. And so the Yorba Linda property was a citrus ranch, and the crops had been failing. Frank Nixon, his father, Anna Nixon, his mother, made the decision to take their 4 young boys to Whittier, where their better prospects lay for a better life. And so they opened up Nixon's Market out of a converted old church. And when Richard Nixon was 14, he would get up at 4 in the morning every day, and he'd take the family car to downtown Los Angeles, and he'd go to the vegetable and fruit markets, and he'd pick the freshest and ripest fruits, and he'd get back into the car, drive him back to Nixon's Market, stock the wares in the store, and then he'd go to school. So Whittier really, I think, is foundational to understanding Richard Nixon as a young boy and then as a young man. Of course, after he went to Whittier College and then Duke Law School, he returned to Whittier. It's where he met his wife, Patricia Ryan. They met at a play where they were actually cast opposite each other, and he famously said to her on that opening night, "I'm going to marry you someday." And they did two years later. His first law office was there in Whittier. It's in a building that still stands here, and guests can tour through it. So there's Whittier figures very prominently in the Nixon story.
President Nixon was alive for 20 years after his resignation, and a good deal of the latter years were involved in the planning of the library. He was at its dedication in 1990. We have a brief clip of some of his remarks I want to show the audience.
I hope all of you will have an opportunity to take a tour of the library, and I hope that you will, when you see there, you will share some of the things that my colleagues, the former presidents, and President Bush have referred to. What you will see, among other things, is a personal life, the influence of a strong family, of inspirational ministers, of great teachers. You will see a political life, running for Congress, running for the Senate, running for governor, running for president, 3 times, won some, lost some, all interesting. And you will see also the life of a great nation, 77 years of it, a period in which we had unprecedented progress for the United States. And you will see great leaders, leaders who changed the world, who helped to make the world what we have today. Seeing those things, will certainly be interesting. Let me remind you that when you go through this library, I hope you will remember that while the past is interesting, it is important only insofar as it points the way to a better future.
What resonates with you about those remarks?
He said it best, Susan. That's exactly the mission of the Nixon Foundation. And I hope that we are living up to President Nixon's call to have the library and his foundation be an active place of study, of debate, of analysis, one of our key educational outlets that presidential libraries are in the country. You know, what's really special, I think, about the Nixon Library is that it contains, as he said, his whole life. He was born on this property, and he and Mrs. Nixon are buried on this property. There's a whole life that now physically is only separated by about 50 feet. But you think of, they traveled all over the world together in pursuit of American interests over a period of 50 years. And you can come here to the library and see it all. And not only do visitors and the everyday public come to visit, but the library is one of the top destinations as a forum for policymakers to come and set their or proclaim their agendas. Just within the last 2 years, we've hosted Secretary of State Mike Pompeo for a major address on U.S.-China relations. Of course, President Nixon, very famously, was the first president to go to China in 1972. We hosted the EPA, EPA Director Andrew Wheeler for a speech on the EPA today. Of course, Richard Nixon created the EPA rather famously in 1970. Just yesterday, we had coming in virtually for the first, for the inaugural Nixon National Cancer Conference, we had NCI Director Ned Sharpless, President Biden's NCI Director, spoke to about 200 people in our East Room. So the library, you know, not only tells the Nixon story, but serves as a very active forum today for policymaking.
You mentioned that President Nixon went to Whittier College. You're a graduate of Chapman University. Chapman seems to have a lot of connections with the Nixon Library. The president serves on the foundation board. Hugh Hewitt, whom you mentioned, teaches or has taught law there. You're an alumnus. What is the connection between Chapman? Tell me about it, first of all. And what's the connection between the two institutions?
Well, that's a great question, Susan. Chapman is has a certain number of benefits that we enjoy together with in partnership. They're only about 10 miles away from the library. We've worked with Chapman to build a presidential studies center with two historians that study not only Richard Nixon, but really 20th century American politics and the presidency. So if we can use the vast Nixon archives, there's 47 million pages of documents, over 300,000 photographs, 2 million feet of film. If we can open these documents to students through the Presidential Studies Center at Chapman University, we will be fulfilling our educational mission and allowing those students a hands-on educational experience to come here and really learn so many different aspects of American history and international politics. As you said, Dr. Strupa is on the board, on our board. Hugh Hewitt is a member of the law school faculty at Chapman. George Arduous, Ambassador Arduous, is a longtime supporter of both Chapman and the Nixon Library, and his wife Julia and his daughter Lisa. And his foundation are still enormously supportive. So, you know, there's a great educational relationship between the two institutions that, frankly, we both benefit from.
We've talked about Hugh Hewitt a few times already. He was the first CEO of the foundation, came back, as you mentioned, for a second stint just recently as your immediate predecessor. We have a clip from an interview with him talking about his association with Richard Nixon.
How much time did you spend around Richard Nixon?
A lot for 2 years, in 1978 to 1980, and then quite a lot from 88, 89, and 90 when the library was being built.
What did you do with the library?
I was the executive director overseeing its construction in Yorba Linda, California, when he was back in New Jersey organizing its contents. I was overseeing its construction, flying back and forth. And in San Clemente, I was one of his writing staff.
What did that cost?
Nixon Library was $22 million. Privately raised.
Where'd the money come from?
There was not one gift larger than $2 million. I believe Bob Aplanop gave $2 million, but I'd have to check my facts. It was a lot of...
He's the aerosol man?
Yeah. Yeah, very well. Very good memory. And Bill Simon, the former Secretary of the Treasury, was the chairman of the foundation that raised it. Most of it was raised before I got there.
Why did you do that?
Because the president had been very good to me. President Nixon had been very good to me. He was the best boss I ever had. He would spend an endless amount of time answering questions. I wasn't a very good writer when I started. I was a very good writer when I finished. Ray Price was the chief of the writing staff. There were three of us, Todd Lindbergh, myself, Ray, and the president, who wrote everything out in longhand. Great editor. He taught me how to read. He taught me what to read. He invested a lot of time in young people.
Many people watching will know Hugh Hewitt through his longtime radio talk show. You knew him in a different capacity, still know him that way. He talked about President Nixon mentoring him. What did the Hugh Hewitt relationship do for you?
Much of the same that he just talked about with regard to President Nixon. Hugh is one of my closest friends and mentors. He taught me a lot about not only nonprofit management, but media and communications, events, how to get things done. Hugh has an amazing ability to get things done and to think strategically. And, you know, if I again, like I said earlier, I'm able to absorb these things through mentors, through osmosis, I believe. And in the case of Hugh, that's certainly true.
He is returning to the board, as you mentioned. He was, if you look on the website, he was a very frequent moderator of events. Will he continue in that role, or are you going to be doing more of that?
We will, well, as he said, you know, Jim, you're the boss now. But he has said that he will do anything to support us and support the success of the foundation. And believe me, I'm going to take advantage of it.
Tell me about that board, 24 members, who's on it?
Sure. Our chairman, Dr. Jim Kavanaugh, really another of my mentors, an inspirational man, a brilliant mind, got a start at HEW in the late 1960s, and then was brought over to the White House to the Domestic Council in 1970, ended up running healthcare policy in the Nixon administration, played a major role in yesterday's Nixon National Cancer Conference, and really plays a role in setting the strategic direction of the foundation. Really an amazing individual. So we have 24 members of the board. Four Nixon family members serve on the board. President Nixon's two daughters, Tricia Nixon Cox and Julie Nixon Eisenhower. Tricia's son, Christopher Nixon Cox, and Julie's youngest daughter, Melanie Eisenhower, both on the board as well. Former California Governor Pete Wilson is on the board. Everett Alvarez, the longest held prisoner of war in Vietnam. If you can believe it, Everett was held for 8.5 years in the so-called Hanoi Hilton. Absolutely inspirational figure who I'm privileged to call a friend. And Everett is on our board as well. It's a group of dedicated individuals who are passionate about education, American history education and civic education. And I'm privileged to work with all of them.
We have a bit of video of Julie Nixon Eisenhower talking about her father at a foundation event. I want to show that just to give you an opportunity to talk about how the Nixon family members are involved in the work of the foundation.
If my father were with us tonight, he would say to all of you, thank you. Thank you, men and women of the Nixon administration, for serving in the most challenging times imaginable, and for doing a job superbly and brilliantly. So many achievements in 5.5 years. And he would say thank you to the bigger Nixon family, the friends, the supporter who have come here tonight to celebrate. Sometimes I'm asked what it was like for my family to defend my father during the embattled moments in the White House. And my response is simple. He was the best father in the world. He loved this country, and he made us proud.
So how does the family get involved in addition to sitting on the board?
Well, before I answer that, I just wanted to, that was a great clip. That was at the 2013 centennial birthday dinner at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, which I was at. And I think Julie brought down the house. She was the last one to speak, and it was great to go out on that note. The family is involved largely by giving advice. And I'm in touch with Tricia and Julie regularly, and they are close confidants. And few people are able to give better advice because they were there. And not only were they there throughout the entirety of course of the Nixon presidency, but you know, this is their father and their mother who really play these pivotal roles in American history. What I really admire about, well, one of the many things that I admire about Tricia and Julie is that they both recognize the need to get new generations involved. And both were very supportive of me in this role. And I really love that Christopher and Melanie are both involved with us on the board. Again, representative of that next generation.
How involved in the details of the exhibits and also the kinds of speakers that you book are the board? Does it have a yay or nay function as to the content of the library and the direction that you take from an editorial historical perspective?
The, the board really empowers the CEO. And of course, I consult widely with the board as advisors. But really, it's the CEO that sets the direction.
For the first 17 years, the Nixon Library declined to be part of the National Archives system. I guess I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit of the history of why ultimately the decision was made to join the NARA, as it's called, National Archives and Records Administration.
Sure. At the time, we felt that, and again, this predates me, but that it was important that the Nixon legacy be assessed by, again, the next generation, future scholars, in the fairest, most accurate way possible. And to do that, it was decided that the files needed to come to Yorba Linda, like those 47 million pieces of paper, 2 million feet of film, over 300,000 photographs from every aspect of Richard Nixon's life and career. They were held after the president's resignation from, as you said, 74 till about 2004. They were held in College Park, Maryland. And the National Archives was making progress, but it was decided that they really belonged in Yorba Linda. We had the library in Yorba Linda, we had the birthplace in Yorba Linda. President and Mrs. Nixon were buried in Yorba Linda. And so for scholars and those interested in American history, students writing term papers, in order to really understand the entirety of his life and career, it was felt that the papers and the archival materials needed to be here in Yorba Linda. And to do that, we needed a new relationship with the National Archives.
So nothing is in College Park anymore. Everything is in Yorba Linda.
Physical tapes are still held in cold storage in College Park. But all of the copies that are available for research are here in Yorba Linda. So other than those physical tapes, yes, everything else is now in Yorba Linda.
And who is the owner of all the Nixon-related materials?
It's a very complicated answer. it depends on the collection. So the Nixon presidency, obviously, as a result of one of the many legacies of Watergate, the Nixon files from the White House were essentially seized by the U.S. government. That was a departure from the practice of the past. John F. Kennedy's files, Lyndon B. Johnson's files, the Eisenhower administration files, they were all determined to be the personal property of the president. That all changed after Watergate. So the files that from the Nixon presidency, from the White House, January of 69 to August of 74, those are entirely under the custody of the National Archives, the United States government. Prior to the Nixon presidency and after the Nixon presidency, so 1913 to 1969 and 1974 to 1994, it really depends on the collection. For example, the Nixon Foundation is the sole owner of the post-presidency papers, 74 to 94. The vice presidential papers, it's a mix. Some of them President and Mrs. Nixon deeded to the U.S. government very famously. And in other cases, the early life material is owned by the foundation. Some of it is still owned by the Nixon family. It really depends on the collection. So if there is a researcher out there that's interested in a particular collection and reviewing a particular collection, get in touch with us at the Nixon Foundation and we can help you out.
So when NARA comes on board, you also get federal government archivists that work with the collection. So do they have purview over all of them, no matter who it belongs to do the research? Or does the foundation have its own set of archivists that looks through the family material?
It just depends upon the collection. So again, for all of the publicly owned materials, those are squarely in NARA's purview. For the privately owned collections, the foundation really administers those and will consider requests to research them on a case-by-case basis.
Do you ever turn down requests?
We do, depending upon what the request is. We really try to work with historians and people that are coming in. We want to get the full story out. We want to get books written and movies made and podcasts done. if we turn down a request, we're going to work with the generally we're going to work with the person who made the request to try to make it work. We are very supportive of scholarship, and we do fund scholars who come out here to Yorba Linda to research in the National Archives Research Room or through the Foundation Collections. You know, like I said, research and support for scholarship is a major element of our mission.
So one of the goals of this conversation is that people understand how these foundations and presidential libraries work, because there is public money and public staff involved in it. So overall, how large is the staff, the foundation staff plus the NARA staff that works there?
So on the foundation side, we have about 60, and a number of those are part-time. All of the foundation staff are privately funded, and that's through fundraising and through the foundation's endowment. They're funded through our operating accounts. On the National Archives side, I believe they're a staff of about 20 here in Yorba Linda. They have a director, Mike Elsey, who's a wonderful guy who it really is committed to a deeper understanding and using his the powers of his agency that he can to help to get the Nixon story out. And we work together on that. So the way that the library complex itself is split up, for lack of a better term, is that certain portions are controlled by the foundation, certain portions are controlled by NARA. And this will vary depending upon the presidential library in question. No two presidential libraries are alike. So, we split costs, we split labor. It really all depends upon the function in question, but we really do have a very positive and a very healthy relationship from the archivist David Ferriero all the way on down.
What is the annual budget of the entire operation, and how much of that comes from federal funds?
So the foundation's operating budget is about $10 million, and again, all that is private. You'd have to check with the National Archives to see how much of the total National Archives appropriations are given to the Nixon Library itself. But I'll tell you that when it comes to the split costs that I mentioned earlier, the National Archives does control more square footage in the library right now, and so they do bear a larger burden of the electrical and maintenance costs, and that those are public funds. But the foundation recently raised $25 million to completely renovate and overhaul the Nixon Library and Museum. We opened that about 5 years ago. Wonderful guy in a business titan named Fred Malik, who was a mentor of mine, raised the $25 million to redo that library. So that was all privately raised. And then the foundation donated the completed library and museum after the renovation to the U.S. government.
So your portion of it is private donations, private solicited donations, also memberships people can belong. You also rent the facilities out. So what happened during COVID? You weren't getting admissions to the library. You couldn't rent the facilities out. So how did you survive the last almost 2 years?
COVID was tough. I mean, like institutions across the country, and particularly museum institutions across the country, COVID was, it changed everything. But we took advantage of the opportunities that we could offer as a closed facility. Again, like you said, Susan, we had no income coming in. Our endowment was a disaster. We had no revenue from private event sales. We had no admissions. Membership was about our only revenue stream, and even that took a hit. So, we took advantage of what we could, and that was our position in the community and the fact that we could do good things for good people and try to, as Mrs. Nixon did as First Lady, try to alleviate some of the suffering and to encourage volunteerism. So we launched what we call our Conquering COVID campaign. Excuse me. That included more than 40 blood drives with the American Red Cross and other blood banks here in Southern California. We donated, we used the East Room at the Nixon Library. We have a full-scale replica of the East Room in the White House, which is just beautiful. And we do foundation events in there, and it's one of the spaces that we rent out as well. We brought in beds that folks would lay in, and blood was taken, and that would go to the blood banks because, as you recall, very early in the COVID pandemic, there was a shortage of blood. So again, what we considered, what can we do to help? We acquired 1 million masks from a very generous businessman in New York City, and we donated 700,000 of those masks to small businesses in the community, to schools, and to try to encourage economic activity there again, to try to get kids back in school and to keep people safe. I mean, that's really what it came down to. We had 4 food drives. We partnered with local centers of worship in our community, and people came through and were able to pick up food to feed their family. So, even though we were closed, we really made the best out of it, and we benefited a heck of a lot of people.
The challenge that you as a public historian and all museums have is operating in the digital age when audiences are much more accustomed to fast-paced digital events, often in their own homes. So how are you, you've talked a number of times about the challenge of reaching millennials. How are you approaching that? How do you get people through the door in the digital age?
Social media. That is the key right now. Social media and podcasts. I mean, taking advantage of the opportunities that are out there. We have a first-rate communications and department that looks at every conceivable opportunity. For example, as I mentioned earlier, yesterday and the day prior, we hosted the inaugural Nixon National Cancer Conference. We had 3 Nobel laureates that came in to participate. We had several former directors of the National Cancer Institute. We had the current director of the National Cancer Institute. And so as we were interacting with these scientists and doctors and clinicians that were coming in from all over the country, we considered in advance, how do we project that out, right? So our newest special exhibit, which we just opened 2 days ago, is called A Commitment to Hope, Richard Nixon and the National Cancer Act. In order to get that exhibit out into the public eye and to raise awareness about that exhibit, we worked with a number of these doctors and Nobel laureates to put them on tours of the exhibit. When they're in there, we ask for their thoughts. What do you think about this? Or what are the practical implications of the National Cancer Act today? And then we were able to build those into Instagram packages, Facebook Live videos, tweet those out, and through LinkedIn. I mean, LinkedIn has an amazing algorithm for the business and finance community. So it's really taking advantage of every opportunity that we can and touching those demographics, but particularly that under 45 demographic. And so, social media really is key. And then I also mentioned podcasts. Like I said, we have a couple of podcasts that we're working on right now that largely key off of key 50th anniversaries of the Nixon administration. That's really what we are celebrating and commemorating right now. We are in going to year 4 of what we're loosely calling the 50s. But over the last several years, we've commemorated the 50th anniversary of the Nixon Doctrine, the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, 50th anniversary of the establishment of the EPA and environmental great environmental movement that happened in 1970. And then we're obviously looking ahead to the 50th anniversary of President Nixon's trip to China, trip to Russia, the ending of the Vietnam War, and the bringing home of the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, bringing home of the POWs, 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, and the 50th anniversary of Watergate. So we, as a foundation, build educational experiences and events, conferences around these types of programs, or I should say around these 50th anniversaries, and make them into types of programs. And then we push those out all across social media. And we are connecting. It is working. We do hear from young people that say, gosh, I didn't know about that. Or, I'd only heard that there was this thing called Watergate. You know, I didn't know that President Nixon was the first president to negotiate an arms control agreement with the Soviet Union. I mean, there are real learnings that that are being had. And again, that's in support of our mission.
So it sounds as like getting people in the door of the museum as tourists is becoming less and less important, and more important getting the word out through digital means and then having conferences and seminars. So the mix is changing over the years that you've been there.
I would say that they're equally important, though, Susan, important in different ways. You know, in order to get visitors here to the library, we have to have products for them to come see. Some will come because they're history buffs like me, or they're interested in a particular aspect of American history or the Nixon legacy. Still others will come for a particular special exhibit that we might be displaying, whether it's the cancer exhibit, or we had a very popular Apollo 11 exhibit a few years ago. Our next exhibit opening next May is going to be all on the Cold War. And that one's going to be, we think, very popular. So, you know, visitors come for different reasons. So you have to have products that attract different visitors. You know, prior to COVID, we were a top destination for visiting Chinese nationals. Again, because President Nixon is so highly regarded in China and among the Chinese people for his famous trip there, historic groundbreaking trip there in 1972. You know, so there, tourism and drawing in tourists to the library still is a very high priority. It's just, as you alluded to, it's the changing nature of that, you know, and much more of that is now done online. You have to have brand recognition in among the groups that you are trying to get to come visit. And then you have to ultimately have products that people want to see.
So in the museum itself, in the materials, you say the ongoing most popular is, of course, the Watergate exhibit. And in the rebuild of the library, you readdressed it. I wanted to start that part of our conversation by listening to Richard Nixon himself briefly. And these are the famous series of interviews he gave to David Frost just after leaving the White House. Very poignant question at the end when he was asked about his reflections on the aftermath and impact of Watergate. This is a brief clip. Let's listen.
I let down my friends. I let down the country. I let down our system of government and the dreams of all those young people that ought to get into government but will think it's all too corrupt and the rest. Yep, I let the American people down. And I have to carry that burden with me for the rest of my life.
So, Jim Byron, how is Watergate portrayed in the new revamped Nixon Library?
Well, obviously, Watergate was a crime of consequence that would define a scandal that has repercussions today that we're still experiencing, political repercussions, legal repercussions. And we're still learning a lot about Watergate, particularly over the last couple of years. There's been a number of new revelations regarding the Watergate special prosecutor's files. You know, so as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, the story of Watergate isn't over. It remains endlessly fascinating. And, you know, I think that what it's revealing is that there is this great thirst for a fuller understanding of President Nixon. You know, like I said earlier, there's 17 books in the works right now about President Nixon. There's 3,600 hours of the famous Nixon White House tapes. Pretty much every tape that is out right now is going to be it. There aren't very many other tapes that are going to be coming out. About 5% of those 3,600 hours have to do with Watergate. And a lot of the requests that I'm hearing from historians that they're getting about the tapes have nothing to do with Watergate. So, you know, there really is this thirst for a deeper understanding of President Nixon. And if you take the Watergate gallery in the library, you know, it's put alongside a larger story. It's a key part of a larger story. And, you know, it is the largest gallery devoted to a single subject, as it was in 1990 when the Nixon Library opened. And you know, visitors can come and they can learn about what happened, and they can contextualize it. You'll see at the Nixon Library that when visitors go through the Watergate Gallery, they then start to learn about President Nixon's early life. And so what we've tried to do there is communicate to visitors that at one of the most difficult periods in our country's history and at a difficult period for President Nixon personally, it's very important to understand who he was as a man. And so when you round that corner coming out of the Watergate exhibit, you look out these enormous windows at the birthplace home, the home that his father built in which he was born, and learn about his family and his early life in Yorba Linda and Whittier, and really realize that this was a man who was a visionary leader, who was committed to public service, who had bipartisan achievements, and who was really the world and the nation's preeminent geopolitical grand strategist. You know, in that clip that you showed, he said that he let down a number of young people who may have wanted to go into government. Well, there were a number of young people who he brought into government who went on to enjoy wildly successful careers, and many of them remain personally bound to President Nixon. They are legatees of the Nixon administration. Many of them have told me that UN Ambassador George H.W. Bush started in the Nixon administration. Colin Powell was a White House fellow in the Nixon administration. George Shultz, Alan Greenspan was in the 1968 campaign. Business titan Fred Malik, who went on to become president of Marriott and the president of Northwest Airlines, co-chairman of CBRE. Barbara Franklin, Bobby Kilberg, Paul O'Neill, Henry Kissinger. President-elect Nixon pulled Henry Kissinger from the Rockefeller staff and brought him in as national security advisor. Today, he's arguably the world's preeminent international statesman. So, I mean, there were good people that served in the Nixon administration who got their start there that went on to achieve great things.
Do you believe that no matter how many efforts you make at it, there are some people for whom Watergate will be the defining moment of the presidency and Trump's other accomplishments?
Probably. But, it's an important element of a much larger story. And if we can tell that much larger story, as Bill Clinton said when he eulogized President Nixon in 1994 at a state funeral right here at the library in Yorba Linda. He said, "May the day of judging President Nixon on anything less than his entire life and career come to a close." That was 25 years ago, and I would argue that that's only beginning to happen now over the last three or four years, the last few years. And frankly, I'm excited because I'm excited about this role because I think that history is only beginning to appreciate President Nixon more fully now.
You referenced domestic policy achievements. I wanted to play a brief clip of Tricia Nixon Cox talking about some of President Nixon's domestic policies.
In a turbulent time, peace in the world and justice at home were the twin pillars of my father's initiatives, initiatives that integrated all Americans into the promise of the American dream, and initiatives that preserved our water, air, and land, and initiatives that were ahead of their time in welfare and health care.
During his 5.5 years as president, Richard Nixon deregulated telecommunications. As you referenced, he created the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. He signed the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act. I'm wondering whether or not Richard Nixon would be considered a conservative by today's political standards.
Well, probably not. I don't think he was a conservative then. Evan Thomas, the former editor of Newsweek, says in a video here that greets every visitor at the Nixon Library, he said, "Nixon was conservative in many ways, but he was an activist." And I think that sums it up. You know, as Tricia said, and said so eloquently, he created the EPA. He started, or was a key part of, at the very least, the modern environmental movement. He signed Title IX. He created the just landmark cancer legislation that paved the way for incredible advances in research and technology that at yesterday's Nixon National Cancer Conference, Dr. Stephen Hahn, formerly of the FDA, now with Moderna, drew a direct line from Richard Nixon's National Cancer Act 50 years ago to the development of mRNA technology that is the bedrock of today's COVID-19 vaccines. To say that President Nixon was an accomplished president in the foreign policy field, you can say that. You also have to say that he was enormously an enormously accomplished president in the domestic policy field, because many of his domestic achievements really stand the test of time.
But they are very different than the direction of the contemporary Republican Party. And I'm wondering where that puts the Nixon Foundation's programs ideologically, given the direction of the Republican Party, and where you see common ground with the direction the party is going today.
I'll leave the comparisons to the party today to the historians. But I'll say that, in terms of the foundation's programming, we are all about emphasizing that President Nixon was operated in a bipartisan spirit in working with Congress and has real bipartisan achievements to show for it. President Nixon was the first president to come into office since Zachary Taylor, with both houses of Congress against him, controlled by the opposite party. And yet, he was able to create the EPA, sign Title IX, create OSHA, paved the way for a new relationship between American Indians and the U.S. federal government. He restored tribal lands to American Indians, particularly those in Taos Blue Lake. He revolutionized cancer treatment and research. So, he was, I would argue, not a conservative. I would argue that he really wasn't a liberal either. It was pragmatic moderation. And so if that puts him in a sort of no man's land with today's Republican Party, I don't know if it does or doesn't, but I think that is a record to be proud of, and that's what we ought to be emphasizing and pushing forward from an educational perspective.
You mentioned his détente with the Soviet Union and his opening of China in 1972. You've got an ongoing series of programs that in the foundation, the Nixon Seminar, and its goals seem to be to explore a philosophy called conservative realism. Can you tell me what that means in the context of his accomplishments?
Sure. So, President Nixon was the ultimate realist. That was how he and set foreign policy, and how he and Dr. Kissinger, really operated on a geopolitical scale. As I mentioned earlier, he really is America's preeminent geopolitical grand strategist, and they did this all from a philosophy that's rooted in realism. So, what the Nixon seminars do, or what they are intended to do, is to provide a pathway for the Republican Party today to, and the Democratic Party today, to say, this is what worked then. Here are a set of policy prescriptions that may work, that we would recommend would work now. And it's not the foundation necessarily recommending it. It's the members of the seminar. The seminar is co-chaired by former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and a former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, and has 15 members from the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations, national security experts. And, really we set the topic working with the moderator. And we say, President Nixon did it this way, and here's how we'd recommend that it be done today. So it's meant to guide and recommend and advise, and so it's become, in a sense, one of our many key educational programs that we hope members of this administration and whatever the next administration is, it might be the same administration, and members of Congress, can key off of as they're formulating key foreign policy prescriptions and agendas.
On a lighter note, we have about 4 minutes left. You recently opened an exhibit of correspondence between Richard Nixon as an ex-president and Donald Trump. Can you tell me about the letters that you found and what one learns about the two men from them?
They were, just what amazing finds. We discovered these letters. We uncovered them. You know, anybody who goes searching through the archives knows that it's like you can find a needle in a haystack. And we found a few needles in these haystacks. And so we pieced these letters together. What we were able to determine was that former President Nixon and then New York City businessman Donald Trump had a friendship. They had a relationship. They knew each other, at least socially. And they would bounce ideas off of one another, from everything from football to the legacy of the Vietnam War, politics today. It is absolutely fascinating to have read, to read this, the correspondence between these two men, and to have presented that. We put that into a special exhibit at the Nixon Library, which unfortunately is now no longer open. But it was called the President's Club. It took a look at relationships between a series of presidents over the last nearly 250 years with the Nixon-Trump letters, really breaking new ground that you have to, historians now have to wrestle with the fact that these two men had a relationship, and how does that factor in to, historians' understanding of these two men? I'll leave that up to them. But, we presented some really interesting and compelling new history.
Have you opened the doors to the public again?
We have, thankfully. Earlier in May, we reopened after 14 very long months, and we sure hope that we stay open long into the future.
What's the traffic been like?
You know, like many other museums, it's not where we really would like it to be. I've talked to peers in the museum community, the Getty, the Huntington Library, the Reagan Library, and everyone is seeing, it's a little bit slower. A lot of that, we believe, is due to the fact that international travel just has not picked up. As I mentioned before, prior to COVID, we were one of the top destinations in Southern California for folks visiting from Asia, China, and Japan. Right now, it's a slow trickle. But, we believe that we will be back, and we have a lot for the public to come and see. We have a lot to offer. We have a new special exhibit right now, all on the National Cancer Act. And if you have questions about cancer, we encourage you to come to the Nixon Library. It's a great place to learn.
Jim Byron, 28 years old and the new CEO as of a month ago of the Nixon Foundation, with the goal of connecting with millennials. Thank you very much for spending the last hour with C-SPAN to tell us about your job, your goals, your direction, and the holdings of the library. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Susan, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.